This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, episode number 56 for Sunday, September 20th, 2015. Welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host, Podcast Steve on Twitter. This program is about communications, public relations, and journalism, and we speak with interesting personalities in those fields. In this program, a recording of my presentation at PodCamp Philly 2015 in Philadelphia, I was privileged to get an opportunity to talk about my new book with Donna Papacosta from Toronto. It's called The Business of Podcasting, and you may have heard about it from other social media channels. It's about the business side of podcasting rather than how to plug in microphones or make mixers work. It's about creating a service business out of your podcasting skills and providing podcasting services to corporate clients and others. I spoke for about 45 minutes and took questions, and we had a nice chat with the audience. We thought you might like to hear it. So here we go. And for those technical people among you, the program was recorded using the Zoom H4N portable stereo digital recorder. Hope you enjoy the program. Thanks. Good morning. I want to get started because we have a short time together. Thank you all for being here. If we don't know each other personally, I'm Steve Lubetkin, Podcast Steve on Twitter. And it's easier to remember Podcast Steve, so just call me that. I am here to talk a little bit about my book with Donna Papacosta, who's one of the other pioneers of podcasting. She works out of Toronto, Canada. And
Are you local?
I'm local. I'm in Cherry Hill. I've been in the market for over 30 years and been podcasting for almost 11 years. And I'm here to talk not so much about what's in the book, I will talk a little bit about that, but to tell you my story of baby boomer reinvention. And I'm going to take the opportunity to smash some of the myths that you hear about people of my age demographic and technology. Okay? How many of you have heard that baby boomers don't understand technology? Be honest. Come on.
All right, wait.
You never heard that? Oh, come on. Okay? Or baby boomers don't use Facebook and Twitter. You know, the fastest growing demographic on Facebook for the last several years is what? Women over 55. You know why? Because it's the only way they get to see pictures of their grandchildren. So they had no choice, right? But even before that, the boomers were involved in technology. That's the Grateful Dead performing at the English Town Raceway, September 3rd, 1977. Unlike most of the people who went to Grateful Dead concerts, I actually remember being there. And I can prove I was there. There's my backstage pass. I was sent to this concert by the Asbury Park Press, which was at the time a privately owned, now it's Gannett owned, one of the largest newspapers in New Jersey. And they were one of the first papers to add computer technology to their newsroom in the mid-70s. And they thought it'd be a great idea to send me and a reporter to cover the story. I was the music writer for the day. They sent us to cover this concert. This was one of the last of the Woodstock-era concerts. 110,000 people went to this concert to hear the Grateful Dead, the New Riders of the Purple Sage, and the Marshall Tucker Band. Anybody here remember any of those bands? So they thought it would be a brilliant idea to send us with the portable computer that the press was using in its bureaus at the time to feed stories back to the main newsroom in Asbury Park. That's what they sent us to this concert with. Now, this computer, you see the size of the screen? That's the maximum memory it had. You fill the screen, and then you have to push a button to write what you had written onto a big data cassette. And you had to do that a screen at a time. And then when you were all done with it, you plugged it into an acoustic modem. Is there anyone here old enough to remember an acoustic modem? Yeah, okay, a few. This was, for those of you who don't, a couple of big suction cups that you put the receiver of the phone in. And then the computer sent stuff over the phone. And if you were lucky, it talked to the computer at the other end and transmitted the data. And they sent all of us to this rock concert. where the media were being ferried into the concert by helicopter from about 5 miles away. And it's 60 pounds of gear. We land, then we realize we have to find a place that not only has power to plug it in, didn't run on batteries, but there also had to be a telephone near the power outlet. And, you know, when you're in the middle of a field with 110,000 people surrounded by steamship cargo containers for security purposes, sort of like what they're going to put for the Pope, right, you know, to keep people out, it was a challenge. We found a building a half a mile away, and we're carrying all this equipment. But we managed to file our stories. And as far as I can tell, no one's challenged me yet, this was the first instance of a personal computer, portable computer, being used to cover a rock concert. 1977. So let me hear again about how baby boomers don't understand or use technology. The Asbury Park Press owned a radio station. I don't know if you can see me in that picture, but I'm in that, way in the back. This was election night coverage. I had a little bit more hair then. That's what I looked like way back in the day. A lot lighter and a lot hairier. But we use technology from the start. As I said, the press computerized its newsroom in the 70s, and I learned very quickly that word processing was going to be the future. I never wanted to touch a typewriter again after that. I learned how to use the computer system to pull up stories and use them on the radio. That's me. Yeah. Yep. So flash forward, I went to work for Conrail, and I took my radio experience and the computer experience with me, and it was the dawn of the personal computer era. We're talking mid-80s. And I used some of the radio technology, which was basically a cassette recorder, and you plugged in a mini plug cable into one end, and the other end you get alligator clips. And you can't do this anymore because the payphones don't work this way anymore. You used to be able to unscrew the mouthpiece of a payphone and take out, some people who remember this, there was this little carbon microphone in there, and underneath it there's two little pins sticking up. And you plug the alligator clips onto those pins and you feed audio over the phone. That's how radio reporters used to feed audio back to the studio. And so I started doing that in my corporate career. And then using computer technology in ways that leveraged its ability to be used with the day-to-day public relations work that we were doing. But let me flash back for a minute. I became a podcaster when I was a teenager. I know that's hard to believe. But when I was a teenager, my dad worked at Fort Monmouth in central New Jersey, which was the home of the Army's Signal School. It's where they taught the Signal Corps soldiers how to use radio and even television. They had a very robust closed-circuit television station there in the early 60s. They were one of the first places to use videotape to tape people who were learning how to be instructors, and then use the videotape replay to critique their performance, to show them what they were doing right and what they were doing wrong. Very, very forward-thinking kind of technologies. My dad got me an afternoon at the studio where they trained broadcasters for the Armed Forces Radio Network. And that was it. Once I spent an afternoon behind the control board and the microphone, queuing up records, playing tape cartridges, all I wanted to do was be in radio. So I went home and I set up a little studio, air quotes, studio, in our basement with an open reel tape recorder. Does anybody here ever have seen, yeah, my same group, open reel tapes, magnetic recording tapes? This was how we recorded. The technology that was the leading edge of the 60s and 70s was magnetic tape, and if you wanted to edit it, you used a razor blade and a grease pencil. And if you got the mark in the wrong place, you're out of luck, unless you made another copy. It's not like Control-Z in the digital world. So I made pretend radio shows in my basement and played them for my best friend and I. And that was about the extent of what you could do. Little did I know that you could go forward in to where we are now and make an actual business out of making pretend radio shows, which is, in effect, what podcasts are, right? So, oh yeah. I had an email address on my business card in 1987. 87. I went to a conference in California. I met a guy who had just become the editor of a new technology magazine. And he gave me his business card and had an email address, and I thought that was way cool. So I went back home and ordered new business cards. And at the time, we didn't have internet addresses. We had CompuServe addresses. Is there anyone here who has a CompuServe address? Mm-hmm.
The people who
have it still remember their address. Mine was 76616, 123.
72750.512.
Oh, you put the dot in because you got an internet one. Before there was an internet, it was a comma. You had to change it to a dot and put at CompuServe.com. Anybody else have one?
No? I had mine much later.
Years ago. So I came back and I put my CompuServe address on my business card, and then people said, oh, wow, that's really cool. Where'd you hear about that? So I met this guy at a conference. He's the editor of, and the magazine was based on a computer operating system. He's the editor of a magazine called Unix Today. People outside the computer industry looked at me and said, there's a magazine for that? Think about it. Unix? Spelled differently. Okay. Nobody in this room. All right. Now it's coming through.
How was that bell last 1980 to 1990?
Okay, so. So, my first Unisys email address I couldn't even use. It was an internet address, but I was told it was on one of the first internet servers. Somebody told me, oh, this was a legendary server. I'm like, wow, that's great. Bell Labs is a beautiful place, by the way.
I live in Asbury Park.
I just did a video of the way they're redeveloping it. So flash forward to, let's go a little bit further forward. I got thrown under the bus when I was 48 years old. Mm-hmm. I like to say Bank of America promoted me to customer. And it was the best gift they could have given me because it was an opportunity to say, okay, what's next? I'm a baby boomer. I'm 48. I'm too expensive to get hired by another company. What am I going to do for a living? My first response after 30 years as a corporate communications person was I'll set up a PR consultancy and I'll do news releases for people. That's what PR people tend to do. But when you're a sole practitioner and you're competing against, you know, Fleischman and Hillard, Burson Marsteller, some of the major PR firms in town, Bryan Communications, they have a lot more heft, you know, and no matter how good you are and how great your reputation is, you're probably not going to compete well against the big firms. You know, the old expression, nobody ever got fired for hiring IBM. So nobody ever got fired for hiring a big PR agency to work for them, even if they're not getting the results. But that's another story. So I said, you know, what am I going to do now? My wife, God bless her, was listening to NPR. And she said, you really should listen to this story I heard on NPR about this thing called podcasts. I said, podcasts. I've heard vaguely about it. I knew about blogging. Hadn't really paid much attention to podcasts other than vaguely knowing it had to do with audio. And I listened to the story, and then I started listening to podcasts, and the light bulb went off. As a communications professional, I said, this is a really great way for companies and organizations to tell their stories in a long-form radio format without having to go pitch it to NPR or to Channel 6 or to KYW. But it's got to sound like it was done by those people. It has to sound really good. You can't do a podcast with volume levels that vary from voice to voice or lousy sound quality because you don't have a good microphone. And it has to be edited properly. I heard one podcast I listened to early on where the person was talking very knowledgeably about the subject matter and suddenly said, honey, please be quiet. I'm doing my podcast. It's not live radio. You can edit it. And I said, you know, people have to learn how to edit and pace it and, you know, the idea for a business was born. I'm not so interested in being on this side of the microphone, although I've done it for many years, talking about what interests me. I do a couple of podcasts for what I call the house account. So I do a podcast about communications. I interview journalists and communications professionals and sometimes record seminars on those topics. Meet the media panels are very well received. You know, when they have the panel of news media people who tell the PR people everything they're doing wrong in their relationships with the news media, and they promptly go back and continue to do it wrong. You know, but they listen to the podcast with the news media people telling them over and over. So we do that. We do one on books and music where I interview authors and musicians and play some music by people who are not signed to major albums, because one of the problems we have in podcasting is if you use copyrighted music, you're going to get in trouble no matter how short you keep it. You can't do it. Don't do it. But what I was really interested in was using this tool to produce podcasts for corporate clients. And that's how we got to where I am now, 10 years later, producing podcasts for companies. Now, you know, a couple of interesting things happened along the way. We got to do all kinds of seminar programs very early on, within about 2 years of starting to do audio podcasts. And one of my first clients was a trade association in the printing industry. And they had a wealth of information about all different aspects of running a printing company. You know, financial operations, actual operational efficiencies in the print plant, you know, things that printing company owners need to know about economics. Their chief economist was one of the first people to warn about a coming recession, and he did that in one of our podcasts in the middle of 2006. And if you recall, the real axe didn't fall until like 2007, 2008, so he was way ahead of everybody else in announcing that. But wasn't very long after we started doing those podcasts that they started, and other people started asking me about video. And so my wife says to me, "What's keeping you awake about the business?" And I said, "You know, they're asking me about video, and I haven't got the gear yet." And she said, "Well, go get, you know, get what you need." So I went on eBay and I looked at what it was going to cost.
Let you go get it.
What's that?
Wife let you go get it.
She said, "She, God bless her, she has been absolutely 100% supportive." And you know, one of the keys to running any kind of a business as an entrepreneur, if your significant other isn't 100% behind you, you need to have a conversation before you go ahead. Because if you don't have that support, you can't do what you need to do with a clear mind. You know, especially when it comes to spending money on things. And I don't advocate that anybody spend money on things until they actually have the business in hand. This is digression. But when I first started out, one of my former colleagues from the bank who was working, he was the controller of the bank. He had gone out, as we all did when we left, and was doing some consulting. And he called me in. He says, "I need you to do some PR work with this client. I'm trying to help them with their finances." It was a recording studio in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that was started by a couple of musicians. And these were guys with no previous experience owning or running a recording studio. But at the time, the banks were giving anybody with an idea money, and they built a world-class recording studio in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And they couldn't get anywhere with it because they built it and didn't have the business to support it. And that was the challenge they were facing. We tried to give them some ideas about what to do, and it didn't work out, and they went out of business. So the build it and they will come philosophy, don't believe it. Wait until you have the signed contract in your hand. Every time I've bought something or invested in something that I thought I was going to use with a client who said, "I'm going to sign up next week," I was stuck with it. So just be forewarned about that. But I did the pricing. I figured out how much it was going to cost me. And I was like, "This is going to cost a lot of money to get video equipment. I'm going to hold off until that call comes." And I knew it was going to be, "We need you to do video tomorrow." And I'd be running around looking for equipment. As luck would have it, a friend of mine was retiring and was closing down his side business, which was shooting weddings and bar mitzvahs. Oh. And I called him up and said, "What are you doing with your equipment?" He said, "Well, I'm thinking of selling it. Are you interested?" I said, "I'll be over tonight." And I bought everything he had. The main thing that he had that I wanted were the two cameras. He had a matched set of Sony digital video cameras, which was really nice. I knew I wanted two. I knew that you kind of need two at least. And currently I shoot with as many as four. If you're going to do it right, you got to do it right. So I bought his cameras and I said, writing the check. And I said, hope the jobs come. Within a week, I had the job that paid for the equipment. So that was, you know, you have to make one step, but you don't want to go too far over the top. And by the way, stop me if you have any questions at any time, you know, because I've had two cups of coffee here. So, you know, life in podcasting turned into life in video. And, you know, we began getting more clients and getting more work. And the key for me was, as I looked out at the podcasting landscape, I was not seeing the kind of revenue that people are hoping for when they create a podcast, sit in front of the microphone and say, "I'm going to talk about what I love and I'm going to do a whole, 200 shows and then someone's going to pay to advertise on my podcast." It happens for some people. Donna and I both found out independently that was probably not working for most podcasters. We both have tried that model where you sign up with a podcast advertising network and you have to do a whole lot of preparatory work in advance of putting the show together. Then you read the podcast commercial in the show. Then you put links in your website that allow them to track the downloads and reporting and so forth and so on. And at the end of the day, you come up with maybe $20 a quarter in podcasts, in commercial revenue. So selling commercial time didn't seem to be a long-term viable option as a revenue generator from podcasting. What we found was people hiring you to produce podcasts is a way to make revenue. And one of the things that had troubled me, and one of the reasons why we wrote the book, I've had situations, it doesn't happen often. The economy has been shaky over the past 10 years, I won't deny that. But there have been occasions where we were double booked and I needed someone to record in a different location while I was out on a different assignment. And it's really hard to find podcasters, and I tapped into the network in this area, podcasters who have sufficient amounts of equipment that they could actually go out and do a podcast recording on location. Most people are, you know, in their studio at home with a USB microphone plugged into a computer, and they don't have digital recorders, they don't have wireless microphones, they don't have any other kinds of microphones, they don't have anything that they can take on site. So it's really challenging to find people, and that's when I said, you know, this is an opportunity people are missing by focusing solely on, I'm going to do a podcast and be a radio star. So that's why we came up with this. And, oh, thank you very much. See me later and I'll sign it for you.
I'll buy two. And you can do two for 40, right?
You can do that. Right. I wasn't going to sell in the middle of the session. I was going
to
do it afterwards.
I have to rush it.
But that's okay. Thank you for coming. Okay, so when you have all this gear, you have other ways to make it pay as well. So one of the things I started doing when we're idle is legal deposition videos. I have the gear. The gear is already a sunk cost. So now, how do you find ways to shoot or record to make it pay? And it's beyond podcasting. Okay, this is really simple to do. It doesn't pay very well, but it's simple to do. You don't have to do a lot of editing. Anybody in here do any wedding or wedding videos or anything like that? Because I've tried that too. Let me tell you something. Wedding video is a lot of work. It's an enormous amount of work. You shoot, you're on your feet shooting for like 8 to 12 hours, and then you've got 2 weeks worth of editing to get it all matched up. And you know what? No matter how short you make the highlights reel, I made a highlight reel for the one wedding that I shot recently, and the highlights was like 20 minutes. They walked out at 12. Even the bride and groom stopped watching. Nobody watches them. And so you do a lot of work and you get paid. It averages out, you know, you'd be better off probably being a greeter at Walmart, you know, by the number of hours that you put in. So, but there are other ways to do it. And this is one of them. One of the things I talk about in the book is how I've leveraged these things back into some of the freelance writing that I'm doing. When I record interviews that are going to turn into freelance articles, I also create a podcast kind of a thing from that, which goes up on the website with the story, and it's a value add that you can create. Another thing that I do is when I go out with the video cameras, and we discovered this early on, by the way, with video. Google loves video. If you do video for clients and put it on their website, it pops them way up in the Google search. And so what I started doing was what I call, from my radio days, we call it a news wrapper, because you wrap up the story. Typically, you have pictures of what happened at the event, and you have the reporter in the middle talking about it and interviewing people. So it's a wrapper, video news wrapper. I started doing these for several of the clients I work with. I work with a commercial real estate website called GlobeStreet.com. We just did a feature on the Bell Labs up in Homedale, which is being repurposed by a developer as a mixed use. If they're going to have hotels, apartments, retail, and office in what used to be a single tenant, 2 million square foot facility. It's absolutely gorgeous inside. It's one of the most beautiful suburban office parks. It's probably the only one they'll be able to develop like this, but it's really beautiful. But, you know, we literally do a report. I take the camera, I interview the developer, I take what they call B-roll, pictures of the facility, walking around from different places. I do the stand-ups where I'm the reporter saying, you know, here we are at Bell Labs. And you package that up and you've got a little report that you can sell to people as part of the services that you provide them. A couple of years ago, I caused a real stir among people who are fans of the railroad industry. In 1974, the Penn Central Railroad was on the verge of running out of money, literally running out of money. And they had a real problem. If they didn't have the money, they couldn't pay the crews. If they couldn't pay the crews, the trains wouldn't run. If the trains didn't run, the steel wouldn't get to the auto plants, and a million, at the time, a million or more car industry workers would be idled. So it would be devastating to the economy. And what the Penn Central found out when they went to Washington to get money was the congressmen didn't understand that. They didn't understand the connection. All they saw was Penn Central with its hand out. So Penn Central made what is believed to be the only movie ever made by a company to show people how bad things were. They literally went out and took pictures of the trains running on tracks that were so bad that the cars were swaying like this, right? They took pictures of derailments happening in the rail yards when the cars were standing still because the timbers were so rotted that the rails just spread under the weight of the cars. And they took this 16-millimeter movie to Washington to show to congressmen privately. After they were done showing it and they got the money they needed, which was to carry them over until the government created what became Conrail in the early 70s, the trustee of the Penn Central, which was by that time bankrupt, called back all the copies of the film and had them destroyed, except for one. And that one was transferred to VHS tape sometime in the 80s. And I heard about it, and the guy who did the transfer, I said, can I have a copy of that for my archive? He said, sure. He gave me a copy of it. Sat on my shelf for 30 years. When I got into digital video, I'm going through my shelf. I said, oh, I forgot I had this. I digitized it. I put it up on YouTube. And within days, I had 60,000 views. Because, as it turns out, everyone thought that the complete movie had been lost and only some snippets in black and white had been preserved. I had the only color copy of this movie. And all the rail fans, people I used to work with, people in the industry, were all coming out of the woodwork. Like, hey, great job. You did a great thing saving that movie. I didn't know, you know. But there you are. And so social media, you know, comes back. This is, you know, if you look for Penn Central 1974 on YouTube, you can watch the whole movie. It runs about 28 minutes. It's got interviews with people talking about how horrible the conditions are and how badly they need the money. But in its day, this was social media in many ways. I mean, they carried it around Washington and showed it in private showings, right? So anyway, that's my story. There's the book. It's been an interesting journey, but the point of the whole thing is there's another side to podcasting, and the other side to podcasting is think about whether it fits with everything else that you're doing as a potential business service that you can offer to clients and to others. And I will be happy to take questions. You've been a great audience so far. Yeah.
You mentioned the remote setup and stuff, and I noticed you've got a recorder there. Do you want to talk about your setup here, what you're doing today to record this?
It's a real simple setup. A couple of months ago, I finally broke down and bought a Zoom H4N, which is this device. This is a digital audio recorder. What I love about the Zoom is it has built-in, you see the little foam on the top, it has two built-in microphones. It also has the professional XLR jacks in the bottom, which broadcasters use, so it's nice for tapping into a sound system at an event. But it's also very small, and it records to an SD card, which is great because it'll go for hours. But what's nice about the stereo microphones is that when you listen to the recording, you're going to get the ambience of the room, and it sounds very realistic. Any of you ever heard of the Catholic Insider podcast? I bring this up because of the Pope's visit. The Catholic Insider podcast is one that is done by a priest in the Netherlands, Father Roderick. And he does a lot of stuff about church art and architecture, but he did a couple of really interesting podcasts when the last Pope died. He was in Vatican City. He covered the funeral, and he did a lot of interviews and some expert commentary on, you know, all the ritual and so forth. And then he did a podcast about the conclave of cardinals to elect the new pope. He was interviewing people in St. Peter's Square using a stereo recorder at exactly the moment when the white smoke came out and the bell started to ring that they had elected a new pope. And when you're listening to a stereo recording with headphones on, you really get a spatial sense of being in the place where it was happening. So it was, you know, you could hear the bells ringing off in the distance somewhere over there, and you could hear the cheering sweep through the crowd in a much more realistic way. So making stereo recordings was something I really wanted to do. But until they came out with these kind of recorders, you would have to have, you know, a recorder with two microphones mounted or a very expensive stereo microphone on a pole or on a boom or something like that. This is just a real easy way to do it. I'm sorry? It's called a Zoom H4N.
What's the retail price?
Retail is $200, $299.
I think it's $250.
Yeah, something in the neighborhood. Yeah.
So I'm still in the newbie, the personal part spectrum of this. And I'm wondering, you know, editing, I know, makes a lot of difference, you know, in the
sure.
professionalism and how it sounds and everything. At what point would you weigh, you know, getting better equipment or getting better editing technology? Like, what do you think is the better step up to go? I mean, if you can't get everything at the same time, would you get a better microphone, better recording, or would you invest in learning editing and better software?
So the question is, which comes first, editing software or hardware? Which is the better thing to do? What we talk about in the book is the one key for most people. Most people start with a USB microphone or a headset microphone plugged into a computer, and that works great when you're sitting alone and you're just doing a podcast about, you know, I don't know, scrapbooking or genealogy or whatever your interest is. The problem you run into, and this happens to everyone who tries this, you take that setup and you go out on site and you record to the computer, and that's exactly the moment when your computer decides to either install Windows updates or some other hidden process decides to stop running and cancel everything else that you're doing. So the first thing is probably learn how to use external hardware. The computer's great for the editing process, but to capture the actual original content, you want something that's not going to be trying to do other things at the same time. That's what I've found. So I'm not using my cell phone as a video camera. I'm not using my computer as an audio recorder. I'm using dedicated pieces of equipment that are designed for that function. So that, to me, is kind of number one. The editing part, as long as you capture the content, the editing software and the editing skills can come after, because you always have the original to go back to, right? So capturing that is going to be better. Who else?
Can I yeah. say something, add something?
Yeah.
Audacity is free and it's phenomenal and it's multi-platform.
Yeah.
So
don't you have to pay for
no, Audacity
to host on there? Or
no, they don't host, they just edit. So you don't have to worry about getting better audio right. editing software necessarily.
Right.
And all other options are paid options, but
I mean, I just use GarageBand, so but I don't
perfectly acceptable.
It is acceptable, but I,
yeah.
I prefer Audacity.
Okay.
The thing, you know, and this is like a this can be a Sony / VHS, or it can be a Mac versus Windows kind of a debate over what's the best software to use. Audacity is a great place to start. It's very easy to use. What I found was, and you won't notice this unless you're doing a lot of recording, in the background, Audacity creates a lot of hidden files. And the file size of your project blows up enormously the more you edit it. And you don't see that, because the file that you end up with, the MP3 file, is, you know, compact and small and nice and neat. But then you say, where's all the space on the drive? Where did it go? And then you look and you can find like 5 or 6 gigabytes tied up in these little temporary files. So that may be okay. Depends on your workflow.
Do you recommend any particular?
Believe it or not, I started migrating a while ago to, I use the same software I use to edit video, I use for audio. I'm using Sony Vegas Pro on a Windows platform. Mm-hmm. It's a perfectly good, it's a phenomenal video editor, mm-hmm. and it's perfectly good for editing audio, because all of the plugins that work with, you know, Sony, the VST plugins that for sound enhancement that work with Sony or work with Adobe Audition I think is overkill for most of us. It's extremely complicated to use. It defaults to destructive editing, which is if you start to get into the different kinds of editing, there's destructive editing and non-destructive. Non-destructive means the original file doesn't get tampered with. Audition, if you don't put it in the non-destructive mode, it'll tamper with your original file, which is the worst thing you want it to do. So it's a personal preference, but I find I don't have to learn different keystrokes. If I stay in the same program, it's all the same. So I can edit very fast. But it's a personal preference. Who else?
Do
We have checklists in the book of the kinds of equipment you might want to bring on a job. Yes, sir.
I'm getting ready to start a podcast, and one of the things that I'm really struggling with is the formatting for it. And I think there's like, one of the things I'm struggling with is like finding the example of what I want to kind of mimic. And like, there's so many different podcasts and so many different ways to do it. And I feel like there's like everything from podcasts that are essentially radio shows. Mm-hmm. They're very tight. They're very well produced. They come in, they hit a commercial break at 3 minutes in, they hit a commercial break at five and then 10. And then there's other ones that are just kind of like a conversation that's being recorded.
Sure.
And it just meanders, and that's fine because it's a really engaging topic and it's like great. Is there a certain kind of format that's gets you to a certain kind of like destination versus another? Like, is it just personal preference?
What should the format of a podcast be? Whatever you want it to be. That's the beauty of the art form.
Yeah.
It is freeform radio. It is a lot like the way I remember radio when I was in college, and we played whatever we wanted, and we talked about whatever we wanted. The difference is, to make it commercial enough to sell as a service, you have to know how to do it in a way that sounds like essentially national public radio. You know, podcasting got a lot of visibility, and everybody's talking about a renaissance now because of the Serial podcast. How many of you listen to Serial? Right? I mean, most of us in podcasting did. The thing you have to keep in mind about Serial is that producing that kind of a podcast is extremely labor intensive. It takes an enormous amount of post-production work to make it sound like that. And the people producing Serial as a podcast are still the people who produce shows for National Public Radio in multi-million dollar studios with a team of researchers, producers, and editors. So it's not exactly like, you know, there's a lot of work to do it that way. The video that I produced at Bell Labs, I was there for an afternoon. I spent maybe 2 hours touring the place and interviewing Ralph Zucker, the developer, and then I spent probably another 4 hours in the studio editing it down to a 5-minute video. It's incredibly labor-intensive to do it that way. That's why most of them are conversations. Now, you mentioned meandering conversations. That's the part that you can learn how to not produce. You don't have to leave the conversation untouched. A lot of the way people talk, if the more you listen to recorded interviews, they'll start a thought and then they'll digress. I've done this today. They digress from that thought to something else and then come back to the point they were trying to make with the first thought. So there's no reason why you can't take that digression out of there and put the two pieces together and get a much smoother transition in the conversation. And it keeps the conversation flowing better than if you let people go off in different directions. So it depends on what your need is.
I was going to just offer this. Who is your audience and how forgiving are they going to be if something doesn't sound exactly like it does on the radio? Because if you're doing a podcast that is about a very, very, very specific topic, maybe they're more forgiving. Maybe because they want to hear what you've got, you know. If you're so focused on a laser point on a certain topic, then maybe they're a little more forgiving. But I have found that audio content is audio content is audio content, and that if you are too unprofessional, that may turn people off no matter what, because what are they looking for? They're looking for something, you know, that they can listen to in 15 minutes or 20 minutes or a half hour on their commute. You know, where are they listening to it? They're listening in their car, they're listening while they're exercising, whatever. And if you don't sound to a certain level of, you know, professionality, then they're going to probably drop you. Yeah.
And absolutely. And I do distinguish between the podcasts that people produce for their personal passion and the podcast that you're producing on behalf of a client who's paying you to produce it. If you're being paid to produce it, one of the things we talk about in the book is how you have to change your mindset about the whole corporate infrastructure if you're going to do this professionally. A couple of years ago, I was presenting at a conference with a colleague, with one of my clients. Company was using podcasting to promote the knowledge, the enormous knowledge of their subject matter experts on a very narrow topic of business risks. They're a global insurance company that insures businesses, not auto, home, life, business risks. And one of the points she made was that the podcast scripts go to the legal department for their review before we record the podcasts. In the audience was a person who produced casual podcasts. And it was at the dawn of the Twitter era. So at the time, I had just gotten the idea. I had my phone on the desk, and I was watching the Twitter feed. And all I saw was legal review of podcast scripts, three question marks. But because I saw that, I was able to address it and say, look, you know, you're doing a podcast in your basement. You don't have any legal issues. It's your show. You're talking about whatever you're talking about. But you're talking about a heavily regulated industry, the insurance industry. And they can't say anything in any of their materials that violates any of the regulations they're subject to, or they could be in trouble with regulators all over the world. And so if you're going to do this stuff for money, you have to get your heads around the idea that someone else is going to be looking over your shoulder to some extent. That's okay. It's part of the process, but you need to be prepared to deal with it, just like you deal with, you know, having contracts and licensing and the fact that you can't use the music you listen to on the radio as your theme song. You have to find pod-safe music, and we prefer to buy royalty-free music where we know we have an actual license to use it in many different ways. And we talk about all those things. So that's the gist of it. Todd?
So quick question about capturing interviews. Yeah. So this is something that I know some of us are going to be coming up with remotely, too. So doing it through, it might be with video through Skype or Google Hangouts or other stuff. I don't know what you cover in the book. How do you try to get the best coverage if you're interviewing somebody remotely, you know, who may have no equipment or very building
sure.
equipment to try to get the best
options? We talk a little bit in the book about the technology. The book is focused on the business side of it. There are lots of books about how to do podcasts. But you know, there are some basic techniques. Obviously, Skype is a real good choice. I use CallBurner because it separates the audio onto two separate WAV files, which makes it real easy to edit. Another way to do it is the technique that the broadcasters use called a double ender. And I won't go into all the details of this stuff. We can talk privately about that. But there are lots of different ways to capture good quality audio over distance. And I've done Skype interviews with people as far away as Europe or the Far East. And unless I told you it was over Skype, I mean, some of you would know, but most people wouldn't really realize that we weren't sitting in the same studio when you get done with it. But that's all about post-processing and knowing how to normalize and equalize the sound. And for heaven's sakes, folks, if you do nothing else, Google the term levelator. Google it and download it. It's no longer being supported, but you can still download it and use it on your podcast file before you put it up on the web. Yes, sir?
Just going to say, if you're a Mac user, that will not work.
No, levelator doesn't work?
Yosemite or El Capitan.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
2012.
The point is, there are a lot of podcasts out there where the volumes go like this. And so you got really soft volume on the speaker, and then you interview somebody, and the volume comes way up. And if you've got earbuds in, you know, you cranked it up to hear the soft voice, and all of a sudden, you know, blood shooting out of your ears. So learn how to normalize the sound so everybody's at the same volume level. Sir, you had a question.
So getting back to the business piece, I was wondering if you could talk about your process for finding soliciting sponsors for podcasts.
Soliciting sponsors. You know, we don't spend a lot of time on that because the market economics of commercials are they pay on the basis of downloads. The advertisers haven't gotten their heads around the fact that these are small audiences. So the only people who are getting real advertising revenue are people like Mark Maron, who's got a big media organization behind him, and who's the other guy? Adam Carolla. Right? They have big media organizations behind them. It's just that they're delivering a radio show through the podcasting channel. For the vast majority of us, you're not going to make as much money as you might hope from advertising. The big companies can't price it in a way that you can get, you know, Procter & Gamble to sponsor your podcast. You're going to, you know, you may get smaller companies and you might be able to sell it to them on a flat fee basis. That would be the way I would try to do it, if that's the model that you're going to approach. Joe?
Well, I would say you got to bundle. You got to work every angle that you have, social media, you know, using banners from your website. There's more to it than just, you know, 1,000 impressions, you know, equals $16 for a 30-second pre-roll for 1,000 impressions. But you might only have 200, 300, 400 downloads per episode. But that's maybe all you need. If you got to look at your niche and then go and find somebody that's like, hey, I want to tap into somebody like that. I want to tap into those people that are really interested in water bottles. Well, you run a whole podcast and you get 600 downloads per episode. that's a really valuable proposition for somebody who's trying to sell a water bottle. Sorry, Steve.
No, this is okay. And what I would say to you all is, you know, the advantage of doing this as a business is that your business clients are not necessarily interested in tens of thousands of listens or viral fame. My podcasting client in the insurance industry was more interested in the fact that we did a podcast about cyber liability risks for businesses, data breaches, network security issues, things like that. And the subject matter expert in the podcast was also the guy who managed that product for the company globally. And the 13,000 plus downloads of that podcast he got represented 13,000 half-hour telephone conversations that he didn't have to have. Because people would call and say, tell me about this cyber liability coverage. And he would say, here's the link, listen to the podcast, and call me when you want to talk about the deal. And it prepared people for a more intelligent conversation with him about the business. Remember, the goal of any of this stuff for corporations is moving the needle, getting people to change their behavior in some way. If you're a nonprofit, it means getting them to persuaded that your cause is just and they should contribute to it in some way. If you're a business, it means getting people to think kindly of your products and services and maybe even be prepared to buy some of them. So it's not all fun and games. And so you have to approach it from the standpoint of how is this going to help them move the needle for their business? And it's not necessarily volume of downloads, but getting the right downloads from the right people. Because it's people lying awake at night worrying about a business problem and then Googling the solution. And what podcasting ads or video ads to the Google search is raising you up as one of the solutions to that business problem. That's why it's so compelling for businesses, and that's why we think people should think about it as a business service rather than as a hobby or an avocation. Anybody else? Thanks very much. I'll be here all day. And that will wrap things up for this edition of the Lou Betkin on Communications podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. If you have comments or suggestions about these programs, please write to us. My email address is steve@loubetkincommunications.com. For information about the book, The Business of Podcasting, visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com. There's a link there to purchase the book on amazon.com. We produce these programs in the studios of the Lou Betkin Media Companies in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at beingthemedia.com. This is Steve Lou Betkin. For all of us at the Lou Betkin Media Companies, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.